Okay, thanks very much for the invitation. It's a great honor to be here. So as you can see, this paper is going to be about two things, about boiling water, how mysterious it is, obviously, and also about some philosophical implications of a certain kind of idealization used in physics called the thermodynamic limit. So before I get to outline my talk, let me say briefly what I plan to do. Basically, I'll motivate a proposal to refine a distinction, right? So this is the final goal. But I'll need a fair bit of stage setting to get there. The distinction I'll be talking about between strong and weak emergence, you've heard a lot about this today, naturally, is this distinction is central to virtually all debates in scientifically informed metaphysics these days. And as I hope you already appreciate, it's a very natural one. Yet my hunch is that there are certain aspects of thermal physics in particular which aren't captured by this distinction. And my aim, as I said, would be to argue that understanding what's going on in this area requires us to introduce a new type of, a new concept, basically, a new type of emergence. So this is the plan I'll follow. I divided the paper into parts. Roughly speaking, part one is mostly stage setting. The real action is in part two. So in part one, I'll begin with some generalities about emergence and reduction, their connection, the motivation behind this debate, I'll explain why people seem to care about these arguments. Because I take emergence to mean essentially the failure of reduction, it will be important to clarify what model of reduction I have in mind. And as you know, there are a few models of reduction on offer. There is Ernst Nagel's model, the bridge law model, and also subsequent refinements and improvements on this model. But there is also Jaegwon Kim's functional model of reduction. So that's a more recent model, and thus less discussed, and in the sense of being less tested on actual cases of reduction. All right, so the next thing I'll do is to introduce the distinction I was talking about between weak and strong emergence, the two types of emergence most discussed in the literature today. Quite a few people did important work in clarifying this distinction, and the way they draw it does not always fit to the way I draw it here. So here I'll focus especially Mark Baddow and especially David Chalmers. So I'll follow the way they presented this distinction. I'll bring in some examples to try to fix ideas. So I'll end this first part with presenting how this model, the Kim model, construes a strong emergence in opposition to the weak or epistemological type of emergence. Okay, so in part two, I'll test this model, the Kim model, on a number of interesting and difficult cases, which, again, you've heard a lot about today, so-called phase transitions. Clearly, extremely familiar phenomena involving boiling and freezing. Clearly, there is some interesting work on phase transitions recently. Some of it you've heard it today. But it seems to me nobody bothered to test the Kim model in particular on them and actually show what physicists have known for quite a while, that those phenomena look rather mysterious for reductionists. So it is the application of this model to this class of phenomena that made me think that the distinction as we have it in contemporary metaphysics doesn't quite capture what's going on here. So I argue that if we look at if we look closely at the details of the case, phase transitions come out emergent, but neither weakly nor strongly. So their status seems undecided from the perspective of the distinction. So they seem to hover somewhere in between, seems to me. And my working hypothesis being that their status depends on how we understand the limit relation between the theories describing the macro level and the micro level. And for this reason, I label this new type of emergence, lacking a better term, theoretical emergence. All right, so that just to mark the difference between the two types we already know about. So let me start quickly by saying what I take emergence to be. Well, as a first approximation, people speak about emergent phenomena as following. Those phenomena are supposed to be reducible, novel, unpredictable, unexplainable on the basis of theory. In many cases, the concept of emergence is explicated in mirological terms. So very crudely, a hole is emergent when the whole is in some sense greater than the sum of its parts. One might also say that there are features of the emergent whole which are completely different or new or unexpected, given knowledge of the nature of its parts. So let's see what are the key features of emergence, right? So as you probably have noticed, there is not much consensus on how to spell them out. But a slightly more precise characterization would be as follows. So according to the authors I have on the slide, emergent phenomena would be, to claim that there are emergent phenomena, there would be to claim that there are features of the world, which is objects or properties or laws, such that they are manifested as a result of the existence of other, usually more basic entities on one hand, and on the other hand, they cannot be completely reduced to those entities. So in other words, on one hand, emergent phenomena are somehow constituted by or generated from or dependent on underlying processes, but on the other hand, they are also somehow autonomous from underlying processes. And characterized this way, it should be clear why emergence is a perennial philosophical puzzle, because at worst, this characterization seems to make emergent phenomena flat out inconsistent. At best, they raise concerns about, magically getting something from nothing. So given this situation, it's no wonder that one of the most important contributions in this area is a paper titled Making Sense of Emergence. That's Kim's 1999 paper. So this kind of puzzle is one of the important reasons to bother with this elusive idea, but there is another reason closely related to this difficulty. As Paul Humphreys explains it, we should care about emergence because if this turns out to be a coherent, viable idea, it provides, quote, direct evidence against the universal applicability of the generative atomism that has dominated Anglo-American philosophy in the last century, whereby generative atomism, he means the view that there exist atomic entities, be they physical, linguistic, logical, or some other kind, and all else is composed of those atoms according to rules of combination and relations of determination. The failure of various reductionist programs, especially that of physicalism, would be of significant interest to this program. Also, the existence of strong emergence would provide the grounds for defending the ontological autonomy of the special sciences. And as you clearly know, a good deal of the emergence literature is concerned with the issue of special science autonomy, that is, autonomy from the allegedly fundamental science of physics. Now, we can move on to the basic distinction between the two types of emergence. So broadly speaking, we have two kinds of theories of emergence. They fall into two basic types. Strong emergence, sometimes called ontological emergence, and weak emergence. Again, called by some people epistemological emergence. Now, proponents of ontological emergence consider those phenomena to be objective features of the world, right? Their emergent status being independent of our knowledge. More precisely, we can say that the high-level phenomenon is strongly emergent with respect to a low-level domain. When the high-level phenomenon arises from the low-level domain, but truths about that phenomenon are not deducible, even in principle, from truths in the low-level, or about the truth, the low-level domain. As a contrast, we should distinguish an epistemological type of emergence, that's the weak emergence, which maintains that a high-level phenomenon is weakly emergent with respect to a low-level domain when the high-level phenomenon arises from the low-level domain, the same characterization. But truths about that phenomenon are just unexpected, given the principles of the principles governing the low-level domain. And what makes these features unexpected is our limited abilities to calculate. So just to clarify, the unexpected, surprising, novel element here is not so much a psychological aspect, but is rather linked with our epistemic limitations to predict the evolution of a certain aggregation of low-level components. All right, so I'm done with the abstract description of these two types. So let's see some concrete examples. Here is again a well-known situation illustrating weak emergence. It's a very much discussed case in complex systems theory. No doubt many of you are familiar with it. So what's the idea here? Well, it turns out that if one is given only the basic rules governing the evolutions of the patterns on a grid, like patterns like this one, then the formation and behavior of complex high-level patterns may be unexpected. Right? So such a simple rule might be, for instance, that any cell not having any neighbors, such as this one here, will die the next iteration as if of loneliness, right? So by dying just means that it becomes white, right? The box here becomes white. As it turns out, it's very hard to predict or to compute, starting with those simple rules. There are two or three other rules which determine the evolution of the system. So it's very hard to compute what the behavior of some of those patterns will be. So even simple patterns like this one here, it's called a diehard. If we lay it out on a large enough grid, this will die after exactly 130 generations. So try to predict this precisely. It's not impossible to do it, but it's unexpected. It's just computationally very tedious. So these configurations, like this one, have certain properties, such as disappearing after 130 generations or 130 iterations. And those properties are weakly emergent without being strongly emergent, right? Because they are dependent on the rules and the initial configuration. Now, if we go back to the more interesting type of emergence, recall that its hallmark was irreducibility in principle. And the important question is clearly whether there are such phenomena. Well, some people dare to answer this question. And here is David Chalmers taking a stance, saying, "My own view is that the answer to this question is yes. I think there is exactly one clear case of a strongly emergent phenomenon, and this is the phenomenon of consciousness." No surprise here, really. There is something of a consensus among people reflecting on this issues that consciousness is the best candidate for an irreducible phenomenon. I'll have more to say about this position later on, but for the moment I'll just leave it at this. Because we need to be, as I said, I need to be more precise about what I mean by reduction in what follows, because, as I said, emergence is important insofar as it poses a threat to virtually any version of the reductionist program. So here's the first fully articulated reduction model due to Ernst Nagel, 1961, in his 1961 book, The Structure of Science. As I said, I won't engage with this model. My focus will be Kim's model, but just decided to present it here just to provide some context to this discussion. According to Nagel, reduction proceeds via those bridge laws connecting concepts of the two theories, the high level and the higher level and the lower level theories. And again, as is all known, all sorts of problems appear when you make use of those laws, bridge laws, because we don't quite know what it is or what should be the status of those connectives. Those bridge hypotheses, are they identities, necessary identities, or just biconditionals? But that's unclear. And it was essentially this problem that motivated many people to try to fix this this model over time, and here I list some attempts. Yet, as I said, I'll just leave the Nagel model alone, and I'll move to the more recent model, and better, I think it's a better articulated model, due to Jaegon Kim. Kim introduced this model relatively recently, and one key claim he makes is that about this model is that it avoids using Bree's laws altogether. Now, if you look at the secondary literature, you'll find people people being skeptical about this claim. People like Maras or Ruger, they argue that the model doesn't really dispense with such connectors. So the gain over the Nagelian model is not as advertised. In any case, Kim's is a new model. It's less tested on real science cases, and I think it's worth examining. So after I explain the main idea behind it, I'll just stipulate that emergence is a failure of reduction in the functional sense of Kim. So we talk about failure of K reduction. And now here is Kim's proposal. So a higher level property P is reducible if two things happen. First, P can be functionalized. That is, it's defined in terms of its causal role. And the second is that realizers of P can be found at a lower level, and there is a lower level theory that explains how the realizers operate. So after Kim introduced this model, he also explains briefly how it works. And it does nicely in the following way. So the first example he's discussing is this property being a gene. So if we follow the steps, the first thing we have to do is just to try to functionalize this property. And the way we do it is as follows. Being a gene is, functionally speaking, having some property or being a mechanism that performs a certain causal function, namely that of transmitting phenotypic characteristics from parents to offspring. So the first step is accomplished. Now, step two clearly consists in finding the lower level realizers for that property, and also the theory that explains how the realizers work. The realizers are, of course, DNA molecules, and the theory will be the molecular biology. So again, it looks like we are done with this reduction. We know finally how to reduce the phenotypic characteristics, the higher level features, genetically inherited features, such as, let's say, eye color, to a molecular basis. Now, Kim also takes up the hardest case, perhaps. The reduction of qualia, such as pain, and here is how this works. So, here is what he says with regard to the first step. If pain is to be reduced to a brain process, the following must be accomplished. Pain must first be given a functional definition. Then we must identify its neural realizers. Broken down, the two steps are as follows. So the first step involves conceptual work. Says Kim, is the concept of pain functionally definable? And if so, how should the functional definition of pain be formulated? The second step, that of discovering the realizers of pain, is up to empirical scientific research. It is in effect the research project of finding the neural correlates of conscious experiences. Now, clearly, as far as we know, the realizers of mental phenomena got to be brain phenomena. And in particular, the realizers of pain will be excitation of C fibers. Now, it's important to note that on Kim's view, the crucial step is the first one, as he says it here. From a philosophical point of view, the crucial question, therefore, is whether pain can be given a functional characterization in terms of physical input and behavioral output. The rest is up to science. But the last point he makes, that the rest is up to science, is worth keeping in mind, because I take it to reflect some widespread attitude that once the conceptual work is done, what's left is more or less second-rate mere computational labor, which things might be difficult to accomplish but rather unproblematic. So it's good to keep in mind that he and other people seem to be dismissing this second step in a reduction. Alright, so now here is Kim's view on step one. He is well known, he is doubtful that this step can be passed for qualia, in his own words. I'm with those who do not believe pain and other sensory states can be given functional characterizations. For what follows, the reasons he holds this are irrelevant, so I won't elaborate on his skepticism. What interests me here is that we have a case in which what the model delivers, the K model, delivers is something that fits many people's intuitions, namely that qualia are emergent. So I'll summarize Kim's view in the following way. Qualia, or pain in particular, are emergent in this model because they're not reducible. And more precisely, reduction fails at step one. Right, so we cannot functionalize. While it seems possible to reduce it, once the first conceptual step is passed, right? So, going back to the classification of types of emergence, strong emergence is identified with failures at step one. Once step one is passed, all that's left is at most the possibility of weak emergence. That is the epistemic predicament consisting in the difficulties to compute the workings of the realizers within the lower level theory. All right, so I'm almost done with part one, and here is what is next. So as I promised, my main goal is to argue that we need to introduce a new type of emergence, and my argument will proceed by way of example. So I'll present a class of cases in which reduction doesn't get blocked at step one, but at step two. So that's one important difference. And moreover, it's not weak but strong. In the sense that the difficulty we face is not merely computational, but it's conceptual as well. So in other words, we'll fail to derive the higher level phenomena from the lower level realizers in principle. This type of emergence, I think, is not captured in the Kim-Chalmers model, and I'll call it a strong emergence of type 2, just to mark this difference. But I'll go even further than that, because there are additional complications to take into account. For the moment, I won't say more about them. Now, one thing to keep in mind, though, is that this strong emergence of type 2 is not what I'm after, ultimately. So it's not what I said I'll call theoretical emergence, but it's an intermediary step to get there. All right, so the next... The next issue I'll take up is to what extent this model claims any generality. In other words, can we apply it to physics? Well, as it turns out, Kim thinks that we can. So he suggests that we can, I mean, he just gives us this unique example, that we can reduce an interesting property, the transparency of water. And the first thing to do is clearly to pin down the property we should functionalize. And clearly this property is being transparent. And we can do it this way, says Kim, is just the capacity to transmit light rays intact. So step one is done. Step two is to find the realizers and the theory that would explain the causal working of those for this property. Kim is not very forthcoming on this, but it's relatively easy to fill in the gap here. And the lower level realizers are clearly photons, electrons, molecules, and the theory is the theory that explains how light interacts with matter is a branch of quantum mechanics, quantum electrodynamics. So it seems we're done with this too. Now, one additional point here is that probably unbeknownst to Kim, this theory had to overcome serious difficulties before being established. Roughly speaking, was that, as you most of you clearly know that the problem is that in the initial form that the theory made absurd predictions such as the charge of the electron is infinite. So the physicists who devised it had to invent a technique called renormalization to avoid those nonsensical predictions, and they managed to put everything together relatively late. In other words, the theory looked like it should have worked, but there was a struggle. And I mention this because the cases I'm going to discuss in a moment resemble this one to some extent. So it's time to take stock and remember where you are. So I introduced the concept of emergence. I also distinguished two types, the weak or epistemic type and the strong or ontological type. I also explained what I meant by emergence as failure of reduction, essentially, according where reduction is understood in Kim's way. Finally, we saw some examples of successful reduction or unsuccessful reduction, example of emergence. Okay, so what I'll do next is to test the model on a class of properties called phase transitions. And what I'll try to show is that they're not reducible in this model. But this failure of reduction is different from the type of failure of we encounter so far. And against this background, I'll urge that we need to introduce a new type of emergence. All right, so we're all familiar with boiling substances, in particular with water. So if we're to apply Kim's model, the first question to answer is how we can functionalize this property of water that in certain conditions it boils. Right? So, one way to proceed is to notice that what happens in such a process is that water changes its aggregation state, right, from liquid to vapor. In other words, we deal with a quantitative change. The observable properties of the substance change significantly. And here's what's going on when water boils, right? So we've seen, Peter showed this phase diagram before. I'm not going to insist on it. So that's the phase diagram for water, for instance. Right, so for each point on this diagram corresponds to a certain value of those macroscopic quantities, temperature and pressure, and just manipulating those macroscopic properties, then we can basically change the state of aggregation for a substance. For instance, we can cross this line here, the coexistence line from liquid to gas, by keeping the pressure constant and increasing the temperature. We can also get water to solidify from the gas state, directly from the gas state, if the temperature is lower than 0 Celsius, but the pressure is also has a certain value. So this would be the sublimation point here, right? This is the triple point where all three phases are in equilibrium, right? At the macro level, we can think of this property as simply consisting in crossing one of those coexistence lines. Right? So just a slight, if the substance is in one of those points, just a slight variation in one of those parameters will take it on the other side. This is the critical point above which, as you saw, we cannot talk about clear gas or vapor state and liquid state. It's just a continuous fluid state. All right. So as it turns out, in thermodynamics, we can make things more precise. So we do this by defining a quantity called free energy for a system. In this case, it's called Gibbs free energy. The letter is G, which is the difference between the enthalpy of the system and the product of temperature and entropy. So this is, intuitively speaking, the energy that's available that's available for work. Is the useful part of the energy of the system. So, more precisely, in thermodynamics, such a crossing, such a transition takes place when this function G presents a sort of interesting or peculiar behavior, right? What's going on is that, so if we represent function G as the parameter being the temperature, the difference between the phases is marked by the presence of such a singular point or a kink in the graph or a sharp corner at which the derivative, the first derivative, varies discontinuously, right? And I'm talking about first order phase transitions. There are other kinds of phase transitions, higher order, but just for this will be enough to illustrate the point here, right? So this is how thermodynamics treats such phenomena. So just to summarize, any of those crossings can be represented or can be captured in thermodynamical terms as such a singularity in one of those thermodynamics. There is other kind of free energy, the Helmholtz free energy, for instance. But this will do for our purposes. All right. So it seems that we're done. So from the perspective of the higher level theory, we know what boiling means. It's just the capacity of the substance to cross one of those coexistence lines, in other words, to have its free energy featuring a singular point. So this is what happens from the macro level perspective, from the perspective of thermodynamics. So at step two, remember that we follow the Kim reduction model. At step two, we'll have to find realizers and the theory that explains how those realizers work. Now, the realizers are obviously water molecules. The theory that explains, governs their behavior is statistical mechanics, quantum statistical mechanics. So, what we have to do at this step two is just to show how a collection of water molecules is able to display this this property here. That is the property of crossing a coexistence line. So the problem with step two is quite clear, but there are surprises, right? Because this is how David Ruelle put it. He said that the problem for the theoretical physicist is pretty clear. Prove that as you raise or lower the temperature of water, you have phase transitions to water vapor or to ice. Now that's a tall order. We are far from having such a proof. In fact, there is not a single type of atom or molecule for which you can mathematically prove that it will crystallize at low temperature. These problems are just too hard for us. Now I'll try to explain very schematically why this is so, and Jessica touched upon this briefly earlier on. Now at the micro level, that is within statistical mechanics, we have to find a way to show that this free energy here, the Gibbs free energy here, has a singularity in it. But when we express it in statistical mechanical terms, we find something like this expression. So G here, the thermodynamical G will be expressed as a function of partition function Z. Is actually the logarithm of partition function. I didn't give the whole expression because it's really not relevant. So the problem is to show that this expression here, the statistical mechanical expression here, is able to feature a singularity or a non-analytic point. Now, as it happens, G, as you see, depends on Z, and as a matter of pure mathematics, this expression here cannot have a singularity, right? It's impossible to find a singularity for this singular point for this expression here. Why? Because Z is a finite sum of analytic functions, and any finite sum of finality functions will be analytic, right? So no way to find singularities in G here. So those are the details I mentioned. That's just a mathematical result. There's nothing we can do about it. All right. So here's where we are with this example, right? So we started with a macro level theory thermodynamics. We started with the expression of free energy, one of the thermodynamics potential. According to thermodynamics, we just define phase transitions as singularities for these functions. When you try to express it in statistical mechanics, you get something like this. And as a matter of pure mathematics, you cannot get singularities in G, right? All right, so we can conclude that phase transitions are not weakly emergent, since the derivation is impossible in principle. It's just, again, a mathematical result. But on the other hand, they're not an instance of strong emergence due to failure of step one, because step one was accomplished, right? So they are, they don't seem to be covered in the Kim model, right? So on this basis, I'll categorize those phenomena as this type of emergence, a strong emergence of type two. Now, as I said before, this is not really news for scientists. People have known this for quite a while, and this is Prigozhin saying it out loud, and Leibovitz as well. All right, so where we are? Well, we just saw that these phase transitions illustrate a type of emergence which is not discussed so far, namely strong emergence of type 2. It's a situation in which the reduction is blocked at step 2. But, as I said before, things are more complicated than that, and here is where the idea of using thermodynamic limit comes on the scene. So, as it happens, physicists were able to, in the end, we were able to solve this problem, solve the singularity problem. That's, again, a very rough presentation of the key idea. So they were able to come up with a certain, some sort of solution, right, to the trick, basically, because it had to be a trick. So they introduced an idealization, right? So they observed that if they idealize the system as a infinite, as being composed of an infinite number of molecules subject to other constraints, the ratio, the volume has to be infinite as well, the ratio has to be number of particles over the volume has to be finite. So they observed that, roughly speaking, they observed that doing the math, they are able to derive singularities for G, right? So it seems that reduction was accomplished in this thermodynamic limit, right? Using this trick, and here is Prigozhin not being convinced of such a move. As you can see, his reaction is 1997. Kalanov as well expressed some doubts as well. So at this point, I reached a central dilemma that basically motivated the paper in the first place. So if we wonder what kind of emergent property is this, so if you think of you know this property of undergoing a phase transition, and we want to use the you know available conceptual vocabulary in contemporary metaphysics. What should we say about this kind of property? Is it stronger? Is it instantiation or illustration of strong emergence of type 2? Or is it weak? Illustration of weak emergence. And I think the answer is the proverbial it depends. So if we are ready to make a certain assumption, that is, the system under study, let's say that the kettle in which we boil the water is infinite, right, or contains an infinite number of molecules, then we have weak emergence. The advantage of this position is obvious, right? It does justice to our naturalistic intuitions. Boiling is not something mysterious. We never assumed it was. Even if we have strong anti-physicalist sympathies and believe that consciousness is special or irreducible, mysterious, it's pretty clear that we'd go too far to accept this about such mundane processes like boiling water or freezing or other very familiar examples. But on the other hand, an infinite system does not exist, right? So it's not realistic, and this generates a problem because the remember the solution via idealization comes with this very high price, right? So many people feel that this solution is dangerously close to cheating. Statistical mechanical systems aren't infinite, right? Chunks of matter are made of finite, small, and stable other chunks. And this is, again, one of the key assumptions, naturalistic assumptions of modern science, right? No question about that. So we see, again, our naturalistic impulse pushing the other way, the opposite direction. So if we stick with this worldview, then we are forced to claim that we deal with a strong emergence of type 2 and not with a weak emergence. Now, if we review the options, we know that the answer to our question can be either. Depending on our attitude toward this infinite idealization maneuver. So it seems that here we have a hybrid type, a new creature, as it were, like levitating somewhere in between the two species we already know. So we can call it strong emergence, quasi strong emergence of type 2, right? So that's the impossible name I came up with. Now, another way to understand what's going on here is to think about what would count as a truly satisfactory solution. It seems that a genuine solution would be to find a way to derive that singularity, the mark of a phase change, which is important from thermodynamics, without using the infinite idealization. And this would amount to a lot of work in the actual physics. Right? So it would amount to theorizing phase transitions in a different way, including, for instance, using Craig Callender's idea of just not importing the thermodynamical definition within statistical mechanics. But unfortunately, there is no different way to think about phase transitions in statistical mechanics other than as singularities in thermodynamic potentials. And as far as I understand, there is not even much expectation that this situation will change soon. So there is some recent work on this issue, but the results are far from being convincing. So, all right, I believe that the most reasonable thing to say here is not that boiling is mysterious, or that the kettle contains an infinite number of molecules, but rather to say that the source of the puzzle is theoretical. That is, it originates in a theoretical failure to patch the two theories, otherwise than via this infinite idealization. Going back to the new creature, this phase transition property, it turns out that the decision on the species to which it belongs depends on how we take this idealization move, which in fact characterizes the relation between the theories. And for this reason, I think we should recognize that this type of emergence deserves a new name. It's a new kind of thing in addition to the vocabulary of contemporary metaphysics of science. And I called it again lacking a better name and as a replacement for quasi-strong emergence of type 2, I called it theoretical emergence. All right, so I'll stop here. And what I have on the last slide is basically a wrap-up of the main claims and the whole argument. Thank you.